and welcome to another episode of Crystal Temple Radio. I'm David Reck, and I welcome you to join us as we have a great interview today with Carl Starkweather. And we're going to talk to Carl about his great knowledge of numerology and hopefully find some tips about how you can use it within your own life. So stand by, and shortly we'll get to Carl. First, I'd like to tell you a little bit about this show. The Crystal Temple Radio Show comes live to you from a real temple located in Portland, Oregon. Yes, we are not just some cool place out in cyberspace. We have a 10,000 square foot center devoted to the evolution of mankind through awareness of body, mind, and spirit. You can find us on the internet, however, at www.crystaltemple.org or reach us by phone at 503-249-0303. We have all types of activities here, be it deep training in meditation, to fun activities like dancing. So if you're in the area of Portland or Oregon, stop by sometime and visit us. We have a store with crystals and healing tools, sage, incense, and different things you can use in your spiritual practice. A movement studio, and a large open temple space with high ceilings. I welcome you to go to the website and see the photographs. It's really quite a beautiful place. I am David Recht. I am the director of the Crystal Temple. And on the radio with us today is Carl Starkweather. Hello, Carl.
Hi, David.
Good to have you joining us.
Thank you.
I think everybody will be really interested to hear what you have learned in your studies. To start with, I would like to ask you, what is it that got you interested in numerology in the first place?
Well, David, numerology was my entry into what's referred to as the field of occult sciences or hermetic sciences. Or esoteric symbolism. I actually was introduced to it when I was a teenager, and my family was going to a Unitarian church, and I didn't really like going to the services, but I went to the youth group, which was kind of fun, and somebody came to the youth group and actually introduced us all to numerology as a group and taught us how to do our own numerology charts, and I was immediately fascinated. And I've been playing with it ever since.
Yeah, that sounds interesting, Carl. I'm just curious as to how old were you when you were first introduced?
I think I was 16.
Well, that's pretty good that you were attending church at age 16. I think I quit a little bit before that. That's pretty neat that you had a church that taught such things as that. I know I like the Unitarian Church and their open-mindedness towards the metaphysical realm, and so that's great that you're able to be exposed to something like that at a young age.
It was a pretty open-minded scene. The two people leading the youth group were professional hypnotists, so they tended to bring a lot of unusual things into the group.
I see. Okay. So since then. Of course, that was quite a long time ago, and you've learned many things, and I'm curious as what other training and things did you have during your life? What types of things did you do to learn more about numerology?
Well, first I started devouring whatever books I could find. I went to the bookstore, and there were several decent books on numerology. And that gave me a good grounding in the basic methods of modern numerology. And then from there, I wanted to know more about the origins of it. And that led me to a study of Kabbalah and eventually astrology and general symbolism, and got me into the Tarot as well.
From hearing you speak, it seems like there's quite a connection between the numerology and these other occult sciences.
They're definitely all connected, yes.
Well, wonderful. Then we're going to be in for quite a wide variety of information this evening. So, next thing I wanted to know was, in your personal life, how has this numerology affected you? Like, how do you use it in your day-to-day life?
Well, first of all, I do pay attention when I hear somebody's name, for instance, because numerology is based on both the date of birth and the name. So when I hear somebody's name, I can immediately recognize some of the numbers within that name, and sometimes that's helpful in understanding where somebody's coming from. And I also find that it's a nice icebreaker with people. To ask them if you can do their numerology chart. The nice thing about numerology is that it's really fairly simple. You can pretty much do it in your head or with a piece of scratch paper. It doesn't require any serious calculation like an astrology chart does. So you can just sit down with a piece of paper and a pen and do somebody's chart in just a few minutes and start talking about it. I also pay attention to numerological cycles as I go through the years. I don't pay a lot of attention to the months and days, but you can do calculations for all of those as well. But it helps me understand where I am in my life and the cycles that exist.
I see. And so getting to these numerology charts, what type of information would be used in a numerology chart?
You mean to make the chart?
Yeah, like you mentioned that maybe some information could be gained from a person's name by doing the numerology on the name. What other aspects might you examine in a chart?
Well, first of all, when you look at somebody's name, one of the aspects of modern numerology is that you separate out the vowels and the consonants. And this is a very interesting feature, and it helps you're dividing out different aspects of the personality by doing that. And then as far as the birth date, in standard numerology, you just take the day, month, and year. And by adding it all together, you can arrive at what's called the life path number, which is a sort of general tone for your life. But there are other combinations that you can make. You can just take the month and the day, and that gives you a different number that has a slightly different meaning. And you can even subtract numbers by subtracting the numbers for the month and the day and the day and the year. You can get information about a person's karma, where they're lacking because of the subtraction.
I see. So you would be able to then determine quite a bit of information about different aspects of a person's behavior or trends in their behavior and their personality from an examination of these numbers related to these birth times and maybe their name.
Yeah. And I find that when I look at a chart, because it's fairly simple, I'm able to get a lot of information from just the numbers themselves. Maybe my psychology is more tuned to numbers, but I find it easier to read a numerology chart than to read an astrology chart, for instance. Even though the numbers are supposedly more abstract, somehow that gives me more leeway to interpret as I'm reading it.
Yeah, and you're speaking about the numerology and the astrology and in the same light, and before you mentioned tarot, so it leads me to believe that you are using these numbers in a way similar that you might use a tarot deck to tune in and maybe bring forth some information from beyond the physical, maybe from your intuition about the person based upon the number that you pull. Does that sound correct?
It's true. In any kind of esoteric symbolism, there's a place for intuition. For instance, when you're reading an astrology chart, no two astrologers will come out with exactly the same interpretation of a given chart, because part of their interpretation is coming from their own intuition about how the different symbols come together, which is far too complex for the rational mind. So the nice thing about reading a chart is that it actually requires you to bring the rational and the intuitive together. In other words, left and right brain have to cooperate in order to come out with a useful interpretation. And the same is true of a numerology chart. And also in a tarot reading, maybe it leans a little more toward the intuitive, they still both need to be there.
So then you're bringing in the aspect of brain balance, so the left and right brains, which of course can increase, you know, brain activity and just intelligence in general.
That's right. When Einstein was talking about how we use only a tenth of our brain capacity, the other 90% is the intuitive side.
Well, it sure would be wonderful if we could tap into that a little bit more. And I know a lot of us out there are working in that direction to develop these abilities to understand what lies beyond our current capabilities and to bring it into our daily life for some kind of practical use.
I completely agree. I think it's an excellent tool for speeding up the evolution of mankind.
You mentioned about separating out the vowels and the consonants in your numerology chart. And could you go a little bit deeper into that? Like, what do the vowels represent versus the consonants?
Well, it's interesting because if you go back into the history of numerology and you go back to the Kabbalah and the what's called Gematria, which was a method used by ancient Hebrew scholars and mystics to encode meanings into words, every letter in the Hebrew alphabet has a numeric value. And in ancient Hebrew, there were no separate characters for numbers. So you could represent numbers through letters. And that kind of led to this tradition of hiding meanings by connecting words through the numbers that they represented. That was later modified by the Greeks in the Pythagorean school, and tailored to the Greek alphabet, which had vowels and consonants. Ancient Hebrew had no vowels, only consonants. So there's been quite a bit of change over time, but vowels represent the emotion and the soul behind a word. And the consonants represent the structure behind that word. So likewise, when you're analyzing somebody's name and you take out the vowels and you add them up, you arrive at what's generally referred to as the soul urge number of that person. And it's their emotional drive and their emotional response to things. The consonants, on the other hand, show the structure of their personality. And then when you add all of it together, then you have their expression number, how everything comes together and gets expressed.
Well, that's quite interesting. I didn't know that about the ancient Hebrew language. That's pretty neat that they work the numbers right into the letters.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and numbers, of course, one of the nice things about numbers is that it's one of the oldest forms of symbolism around, but we take it for granted. If you go into most languages and identify the oldest words in that language, you'll inevitably come across the numbers. First terms that we develop as a rational human are words to represent different numbers.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So we're coming up with many different numbers, from the vowels, from the consonants, from the times that people are born, and and maybe the time of the year or the year of that they're in within their life. And what different meanings are ascribed to these numbers? We have the digits of, 0 through 9, plus maybe, double digits in
and
some
beyond,
that I've heard references to. And maybe you could give a brief explanation of what the different digits mean.
Well, this is what I find very interesting. When I started studying numerology, I was given the meanings of the numbers, and it was just sort of presented as kind of like almost a dogma. And, of course, I wanted to know more about that. And it's generally assumed that this is some kind of mystical symbolic knowledge. But as I researched more, I found that actually the meanings that are given to the numbers can be arrived at rationally. And when you go back into the culture that produced Western civilization, and you go to the ancient Greeks and the philosophers that came shortly after them, what you find is that they were all very interested in number and the meanings of numbers, and they used numbers in their philosophical arguments. And when they were dealing with the meaning of a number, what they would generally do is go to the geometry of it. And so then that brings us to the whole issue of sacred geometry. But often what they would do is they would take a circle and they would figure out, how do you construct something inside this circle that has three sides or four sides or five sides where all the sides are equal? And so you get the construction of polygons. And so when you look at how you actually construct, for instance, a four-sided polygon or a square, as we call it, that gives you some information about the meaning of the number four. And what you find is that you construct a square inside a circle by dividing it in half and then dividing it again. So you make a cross, and then that gives you the four points for your square. And it tells you that four has to do with analysis, because you're dividing and then dividing again. And it also has to do with orientation. And there are other things in the natural world that give you clues, like the four directions that we always use. North, east, west, and south. And that's a very natural division of space. And in the same way, that also has to do with analysis, because you're separating out those directions.
That's very interesting. Do you have another simple example you could give us for, say, another number, so we could see how it differs?
Sure. Take the number 6, for instance. Now, in order to construct a hexagram, or a six-sided figure within a circle, there's a very cool characteristic of a circle, where if you take, if you're thinking of a draftsman compass that you're using to make that circle, it has a radius, and you put one end of the compass down and it's stationary, and the other end makes the circle as you go around. If you take the distance of that radius and start marking off points along the circle and make them all the same length of that radius, you come up with exactly 6 of them. And what that tells you is that 6 is a number of fitting together perfectly. Likewise, if you have a bunch of spheres or balls that are the same size, and you put them on a flat surface, and you pack them together, you'll see that they'll form hexagrams or hexagons. This is the reason that honeycombs are in the form of hexagons. It's the shape that things naturally, it's called close packing in science, the shape that things naturally come together. So 6 is a number of perfection and of organization.
Well, that sounds quite interesting there. What about the number 8? I have a lot of number 8s in my chart, so what can you tell me about the number 8?
Well, 8 is very interesting because it takes the factor of analysis that you have with 4, where you're, 4 is about dividing things out, like the four elements, dividing the basic principles behind what you're seeing. 8 takes that division and divides it again. Each of the directions in a square are divided to make an octagon. And so what you end up with is anytime you're dividing space and you have the four directions and then you divide it again into eight directions, that's usually effectively taken to be all directions. There's usually no need to go beyond that. So eight is I think that's one of the reasons that eight is associated with infinity. And you see that the figure eight is, of course, just the infinity rotated 90 degrees. And it has to do with influence going out in all directions. Like when you have a field that's affecting something, it affects in all directions equally. And it's taking the number four, which is, in a way represents the material world because of the four elements, and it's doubling it. And what that gives you is two worlds. And so therefore, eight has to do with energy being transferred between two worlds or two realities. And so if you look at the symbolic meaning of the number eight, you see a lot of references to exchange. It's the number of commerce in numerology and in Kabbalah. If you go to astrology, the eighth house is about death, which is crossing over. It's also about sex, which is an exchange between two people. It's also about the occult. It's about crossing boundaries in order to influence something.
Well, I find that extremely interesting. In regards to our Stargate project here at the Crystal Temple, we have a 30-foot diameter octagon hanging from the ceiling, which then forms eight etheric walls, which descend down to the floor. And I, in the development of this project, I had always wondered, why not 16? Why eight? Because I felt like, well, it should be 16, not eight, or maybe even 32. You know, because a lot of systems divide everything into 32 degrees. And here you bring forth this explanation of once you get to eight, you don't need to go beyond eight because you're already moving in all directions. And I think you're right. That feels like that's the answer, and that's why eight is all we need. And I also, the descriptions are perfect. Two worlds, bridging two worlds, and that's exactly what we're doing with this Stargate project, is to bridge worlds and cross through dimensional barriers. And that's exactly how you described it. So that's really neat.
Yeah, once you get beyond 12, you've got more things than the human mind can really hold at once. So you're sort of in a different category of numbers.
Yeah, 10-4. I really like the number 12, though, with the 6, forming the Star of David, or known as the, what was the other word you had there for it?
The penta,
what's that?
Of the hexagon?
Hexagon, right. Uh-huh. Yeah, and then I've always felt that the 6 was more complete with 12 when you doubled it. And so in the past, in manufacturing Stars of David, it's like I made 12 points instead of 6. And for some reason, I liked that better. It felt complete. And it seemed to me to relate to the astrological forces and to a more complete spectrum than just the 6, but it still had the same balance to it.
Well, 12 is a very special number. I actually believe there's a fair amount of archaeological evidence that there was once on this planet a base 12 number system being used. In other words, right now we use a base 10 number system. We count up to 10 and then we sort of start over again. In a base 12 number system, it would be 12 instead of 10. Now, 10 seems very natural to us because we've got 10 fingers, 10 toes, and so on. But a lot of our measuring systems utilize the number 12. The whole English measuring system, as opposed to the metric, uses 12 inches and a foot, and so on. And when you look into the words in many different languages for numbers, you find that there are unique words up to 12. And then you start, you know, for instance, in English, the words 11 and 12 are still unique. Once you get past 12, then things start to reference back to 10, 13, 14, 15. The word teen comes in, but not until after 12. And I've looked at other languages, and they're the same way. Russian, it's the same way. German. And if you think about it, a base 12 number system would have some significant advantages over a base 10 in performing basic mathematics. Because 10 is only divisible by two numbers, 2 and 5. That's it. And 5 is a prime number, and so is 2. 12, on the other hand, is divisible by 2 and 3 and 4 and 6. So it makes for many more possibilities in terms of just performing mathematics gracefully.
And don't forget, we have a dozen eggs in most egg cards.
That's right. It keeps coming up. Can't escape the number 12.
That sounds like some pretty compelling evidence to me. I never thought of it, but you're right. There's a lot of things around that are 12 or so.
Mm-hmm.
So hold on just a moment, Carl, while we make a station identification.
Sure.
You are listening to Crystal Temple Radio on BBS Internet Radio Channel 1. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, from the Crystal Temple, located in Portland, Oregon. You can find us on the web at www.crystaltemple.org, or you can reach us by phone at 503-249-0303. And even though we're in Portland, we do have many services that we provide on a remote basis, and we are part of a network of affiliates that spans the globe. So some of our healing modalities and initiatory processes and teaching that are available here at the Crystal Temple are also available around the world and in many places in the U.S. and Canada. So if anything that we're talking about here today interests you, I encourage you to visit our website and look into what we do and call us if you have any questions. I thank you for listening to our show today. We are interviewing Carl Starkweather, world-renowned mathematician and numerology expert. Isn't that right, Carl?
Well, I'm not a world-renowned mathematician, but I do know numerology well, and I like math a lot, but I've never done it professionally.
Well, you're just not world-renowned yet. By the time this show's over, they'll know you all around the world.
Okay, granted.
That's the advantage of Internet radio.
I'm world-renowned now.
Yes. Yes, you are now. Okay, so, Carl, let's see. What is your favorite part about the numerology? What is it you like the most?
I think it's the simplicity of it. The fact that it stands by itself. You don't have to refer to any particular dogma or teaching to do it. It's sort of self-evident once you see it. Doesn't require any complex meditation to understand necessarily. It's just there.
Even though it doesn't require anything else and it stands on its own, it seems to tie into everything in the whole world.
It may be because it's the basis of symbolic systems. I think it was there before the others evolved.
Right. And so it's something then that you would say that the people listening today, they could learn it quite easily. Then they could begin to get the basics and start looking at numbers in just with a little bit of study, huh?
Yeah, just go to any bookstore that has a decent metaphysical section, and they'll have a numerology section, and you can just look at the books that are there, and some of them will be, you know, some of them will be tailored to relationships or you know, finding a career for yourself or something like that. And then some will be just more general information that you can start with. Or just jump on the web. There are websites that have instructions for making a numerology chart.
Do you have any particular author that you recommend on the subject?
You know, to be honest, it's been a decade or so since I've looked at any of the recent books that have come out. So I would hesitate to recommend anybody right now because I'm not really up to date on recent authors.
Okay. How about websites? Do you know a good website to look at?
No, because I don't look at them.
I guess that's what happens when you become a master in your field. You don't need to study the other people any longer, do you?
It's hard to keep up to date because it means looking at stuff you already know about. Yeah.
Yeah, you can grow through application, that's for sure.
Uh-huh.
I know I sure do in my field. The more work I do, the more I learn. So.
Yeah.
What other subjects are there to do with this numerology that you might want to discuss today?
Well, let me see. I don't know about other subjects. I could talk about other numbers,
uh-huh.
But I think I've touched on all the major points.
Okay. Well, would you like to start at one and work your way up?
Okay. Well, one is kind of self-evident. It's one point that stands out, and so it's a point in space that's becoming defined. And that's the nature of one. One is the number of initiative. You're starting something, and you're starting something by saying, here it is, one point. And then you get to the number two, and you have this idea of division, dividing things into black and white, positive and negative, things like that. You have the classic Asian symbol of the yin-yang that's used in Taoism. That has to do with these different qualities and how they interact and how they change places. And you find that a lot when you have a separation, a division, or a polarity. You go far enough in one direction and you start arriving at the other direction. So two is a number of balance, and it's also a number of perception, which is very important. We have depth perception because we have two eyes. One eye wouldn't accomplish that. You just see a flat world with one eye. But because we have that little separation between the two eyes, we can tell what's closer and what's farther away. And as a species, as most species, we have two sexes. And the genders, male and female, separate out different psychological and physical characteristics. And that allows our race to function more completely. And then going on to the number three is a very important number because on the one hand, it's a number of expression and the number of change, but at the same time, if you look at how you build things, for instance, it takes three points to create any kind of structural rigidity. And as I know that you have background in construction and you know this, if you need to make something strong, then there needs to be some kind of triangle involved in the construction. In other words, it takes three points in order to support something, any kind of process. And it's true beyond the physical when you get into events that are happening in time. There are three things that need to happen usually in order for something to succeed. And often we have trouble understanding that, and so we don't get to the completion of what we start out to do. Just like it takes three legs to make a stool so that it'll stand upright. And then you have...
Could you give an example of that, like three things that might be needed to complete something?
Well, let's see. One thing that comes to mind during another lecture I was giving at the temple, somebody asked about a practical application of this principle of three things being needed, and I talked about a business. Any kind of business needs to have three things happening. One, it needs to be producing something, even if that something is a service. Two, it needs to be selling it. Some kind of exchange needs to happen in order to feed resources back into the business. And then the third is that there needs to be some kind of administration. Somebody needs to be keeping an eye on how much money is coming in and going out and keeping a record of it and making sure that things don't get out of hand. If those three things aren't happening, then your business will be very limited, if it survives at all.
So three seems to be somewhat of a key to success.
It is. And if you look at the way that we're constructed as beings, you could say that we have three aspects. We have an emotional nature and a mental or intellectual nature, and then we have a physical nature. And they all come into our psychology to form this mosaic that makes it complete.
Okay. And the four you spoke about earlier.
Yeah, I talked a little about four. If you go on to five, five is a very interesting number because as you're, now to make a triangle within a circle is just a matter of marking off a certain distance and then making arcs and where those arcs intersect. That's your third point, which is interesting because you start with a line at the base. The third point is on a different scale, a different plane. You have to move up from that line. And that's a very important principle of the number three, is that it requires you to look on a different level. That's why people often miss the third point, and they get caught up in polarities. Now, five, it's possible to construct a pentagon, a five-sided figure within a circle. But it's not easy. It's the most complicated of the polygons to construct. And that says something about the number five. It actually requires some creativity. And five, in fact, is a number that's highly associated with creativity. It's considered to be the number of mankind. We have five fingers and five toes on each hand and foot. We have five senses. It is, in fact, the way that we perceive the universe around us through these five senses. And five has a particular relation to the material world as well. In ancient Greece, Plato used what are referred to as the five Platonic solids to talk about the nature of reality. And these are solid shapes that are made of polygons, and they have the same polygon on each side. Think about like a soccer ball, for instance, where it's made up of pentagons, and a cube, which is made up of squares, or a three-sided pyramid, which is made up of triangles. There are only five possible combinations that you can make of those, where each side is the same and they're all equal in physical space. So five is the number of space. One very interesting thing about a polygon or a pentagram as well is that it contains within it a very important ratio between the different sides, you know, the sides and the distances between the points, which was known in the ancient world as the golden section. And this proportion or this ratio is something that appears in all living systems. It appears in the rate at which things grow. And it appears in the proportions between the parts of the human body and in other bodies. And it's considered to be the basis of beauty in like sculpture. The ancient Greeks and Romans used it a great deal. And as well, it was studied a great deal in the Renaissance. So there's a lot going on with the number five. And it also represents going beyond the four elements. It's the fifth element. And Plato talked about this a great deal. The fifth element being spirit. So spirit or ether, as it's also been referred to, is the principle behind physical matter. And so it makes sense that five has to do with space, because space, or the space-time continuum, is beyond just the matter, the substance of matter. And it's also been connected to the life or spirit behind the universe. With four elements, you just have a dead universe, as it were. With the fifth element, you have a living universe, because there's spirit involved as well.
Yeah, and when you take these five platonic solids that you were speaking of as energetic constructs, and you nest them within each other, it creates the portals to other dimensions and to the other worlds. So there you go there. Fits right in.
Yeah, there was a lot of ancient philosophers, like Kepler, for instance, was very big on taking these platonic solids and fitting them inside each other. And he actually arrived at the ratios of the distances between the planets in our solar system by doing that, and demonstrated that there was a natural harmonic in the way that the solar system was constructed. Referred to it as the harmony of the spheres.
Yeah, and that's a whole nother very interesting subject of mathematics that we could get into.
We could, indeed. And then, of course, it all carries over into the other occult sciences. If you look at astrology, the fifth sign in the zodiac is Leo. And Leo is the number of expression, and it's the number of spirit coming through the personality. Now, if you go, we talked about six a little bit. The number seven I wanted to talk about a little, because it's a fascinating number in that it's the first number as you're going up in order, for which it is impossible to construct a polygon in a circle using just a compass and a straight edge like the ancients. That's what they had to work with. And nobody could make a septagon. So it's sort of an inherently irrational number, and it's considered the number of mystery. And the number of hidden knowledge and hidden order behind things, and art as opposed to just science. And if you could make a seven-sided star, it was a sign that you had mastered your art. So it's a certain kind of perfection with seven. And we take it for granted because when in our culture we see seven everywhere. There are seven colors in the spectrum. There are seven notes in the musical scale. Seven chakras. It's throughout all the religious texts. But when you actually sit down and look at all those examples of the number seven, what you'll notice is that none of them are really self-evident. It's always something that has to be pointed out to us. With our strictly rational mind and our senses, we actually can't perceive divisions of seven.
Well, those examples you gave are all, you mentioned the word perfection, and those are all, those examples all stem from the natural world and the perfection of it, and not so much from man-made creations.
That's right. It's a division that's used by nature, but not so much by man. But once man is able to perceive that division of seven, then it opens a new world to him. Music with seven notes has many more possibilities than the older traditional pentatonic scales used by the Greeks, for instance. Now, if you're just looking for harmony within a musical frequency, between different sounds, there are five that stand out that are natural. But by coming up with the other two, you can start composing music that has a lot more emotion behind it. You can introduce creative tension into your musical composition. And likewise with colors. When Newton originally came up with the first color scale, it only had five colors. And then he realized that there needed to be seven because it was the division of a vibration, just like the music scale, and he had the music scale to refer to. So he came up with the other two colors, and that's where we get what's now almost universally used, the what's referred to as the Roy G. Biv color spectrum: red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. And having easy numbers for all of those colors gives us the ability to work with the visual world with a lot more skill.
I've always felt that the symbolism of five and then six, and at six you get the, actually I think of as man at five, because you have man standing with his legs spread and his arms out, and that pretty much makes a pentagon or a pentagram, and representing man. And then at six, you have the balance, because, you know, you have all the equality all the way around, and it's balanced top to bottom and left to right, the symbol is. So once the balance comes into man, then you can move into seven and have the perfection.
Right. So with five, you're referring to the classic Da Vinci drawing that has the man with his arms and legs spread out and fitting inside a pentagram. And it's interesting, there was a study done, I believe it was Kepler that did this study. He was surveying symmetry in nature, and he discovered that living systems like flowers, for instance, often have a five-fold symmetry. They grow as pentagrams if you look at the petals on them. Most flowers, not all of them, but many of them do. On the other hand, inorganic structures like crystals tend to form hexagons. And so we concluded that five was particularly associated with living systems and six with non-living systems. But six is a cosmic number because it has to do with everything fitting together. So the relationship between five and six was studied a great deal by the ancient philosophers, and putting a pentagram within a hexagram was a very important symbolism because it represented man in harmony with the cosmos. And then seven is the great mystery beyond that, the next step, which would be the order behind the cosmos, the secret order, the hidden order.
Yeah, and we're very happy to have here at the Crystal Temple a very powerful seven-fold device made specifically for the temple that includes seven towers, each one tuned to one of the chakras, and it is quite an amazing device with almost 1,000 pieces in its construction, and it is specially fabricated on certain astrological configurations to bring forth the best, most blessing energies into the device. And it is tuned to each of the chakras individually, and as a whole creates a uniform pattern of balance for mankind that then radiates outward from the device, and it's quite an amazing thing, that all based on the number seven.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned the chakras, and it reminds me that where you do see the number seven coming up a lot is in the natural perception of mystics. Once somebody gets to a certain state of consciousness, they start seeing it all over the place. And so people who are naturally clairvoyant will perceive the seven chakras, and they'll start perceiving other groups of seven around them, whereas people that are still in a rational mind frame, cut off from their psychic abilities, won't really see it. It will have to be pointed out to them. But it does come up in nature. We have the seven planets in our solar system, which are the ones that are visible to the naked eye. These are the classic planets. And so the ancients took these planets and related them to their own psychology and qualities within themselves. And of course, that gets to astrology.
Yeah, do these numbers have a direct correspondence to aspects of astrology that could be simply outlined, or is it much deeper than that?
Well, they shed light on the zodiac primarily, because the zodiac, the 12 signs, are also numbers. In astrology, you have the planets and the signs and then the houses. And the signs we have these other symbols for, animals, most of them. which is where you get the word zodiac. It literally means wheel of animals, zodi as in the word zoo that we have. But then you also have the houses, and the houses are a division in space on the planet. When you're standing and you're seeing, like in the night sky, you're seeing the stars around you, you divide that space into 12 parts, including underneath you, and those are the 12 houses. And they don't have animal symbols, they're just numbers. So we say fourth house, fifth house, and so on. Now, they borrow a lot of meaning from the signs that correspond to them. So the first house will have a lot to do with Aries, and the second house will have a lot to do with Taurus. Similar issues will come up. But you can also see in that symbolism reference back to the numbers. It's important that Aries is the first sign, and Taurus is the second, and Gemini is the third, because they all reflect back to these numerological symbols and meanings.
It's all very interesting. Thank you for bringing all this great info to us, Carl. What about, we were at 7. We covered the number 8 before. Before we run out of time, let's get on to the number 9 and maybe 10 or 0 or however you see that happening.
Okay, well, 9 is a difficult one to talk about, perhaps because it's another one that, another polygon that can't be constructed with a compass and a straight edge. You know, you can make 3, and you can divide 3 in half, but one thing you can't do in mathematics with a compass is trisect anything, divide it into 3. You know, except the full circle. That's easy to divide into 3, but anything else, if you have any given angle, you can bisect an angle, come up with half of it, and that's pretty easy, but to trisect it is impossible. So there's sort of an impossible process going on with the number 9, but it represents 3 times 3. And so you have the idea of expression being not just doubled, but squaring itself. And it's a sort of a number of ultimate completion and expansion beyond even 8, which is all directions. The next step after that, you know, when you look at the number 8 and you see that infinity sign, it's identifying the boundaries of a particular cosmos. And so 9 then is stepping beyond that boundary into a new world. So 9 is the number of expansion. In astrology, it's Sagittarius, or the 9th house, the house of long journeys. It has to do with coming into contact with another culture. In our own lives, in our own species, we have a 9-month gestation period to produce a fetus, to produce a child. And that's very significant. It takes 9 steps to complete something. And then going on to 10 is, as is implied in our number system, 10 is a coming back to the beginning. A 1 with a 0, which brings us to the importance of 0, because 0 is nature. 0 is what you really start with. Before 1, there is 0, which is not 1, but everything. So from everything, you arrive at 1 thing, and that's moving from 0 to 1. So 0 is the whole universe, and the world of nature, a circle, likewise, represents nature. So by bringing those two together, and with the 1 in front of the 0, what it implies is that you're able to take initiative over nature. And in astrology, you can see that in the sign Capricorn, where, you know, Capricorns are typically people that have this sort of impulse to achieve something, and achieve, you know, it's often something that's social, or it can be material, it can be financial, or it can just be achieving a certain status. But with Capricorn, with the 10th sign, you're taking that field of nature, which is your life, and having initiative over it. So it kind of represents mastery over the material world. And in our own bodies, you can see that it's using the two hands that each have five fingers, but when you use them together, you're able to grasp things and manipulate them and work with them. And this is a characteristic of our species. Because we have 10 fingers, we're able to do these things that other species don't have. Now, particularly because we have opposable thumbs, but it's really all 10 working together because there are 10 of them there.
Great. You made it through the whole 1 to 10 or 0 to 10. And I'm going to have to cut you off there because we're running out of time.
Well, that's a fine place to end.
Yeah, it is. And I want everybody out there to know that Carl here is available for readings both in person and over the phone for your reading pleasure. So if anybody is interested in a private reading with Carl, you can contact us here at the temple. Again, our number here is 503-249-0303. And our website is www.crystaltemple.org. And you can visit us on the web, and there's email and contact information there. And I want to thank you, Carl. That was an absolutely wonderful interview you gave today with so much information.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. It's my pleasure.
You're welcome, and you have a great day, Carl. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
So that pretty much wraps up our program here today. I hope that you can all join us next week on Crystal Temple Radio. We'll be broadcasting live at 5 p.m. Pacific and 8 p.m. Eastern Time every Wednesday, live from the Crystal Temple in Portland, Oregon. So join us next week for another wonderful show. Everybody have a great evening. Thank you.